Do you find it harder than ever to keep your customer training material up to date? If so, you are not alone. That's exactly why LearnWorlds has become such a standout in customer education. It gives you the flexibility to build training that feels like your brand, not like a boxed-in LMS template. And honestly, the analytics are some of the best I've ever seen. You get real insight into engagement, progress, and ROI without having to become a full-time data analyst. You can also chat with AI to immediately discover anything you want to know about your learner's progress, course trends, or revenue insights. Just ask it questions and let it pull that data for you. The integrations are smooth, especially if you're running HubSpot or automations across your stack. And the platform is actually enjoyable to use for both admins and learners, which I know sounds wild for an LMS. But here's the thing I appreciate the most. Customer education teams consistently tell us that LearnWorlds helps them move faster without relinquishing control. It is learning that scales alongside your product and business. And if you need to even train employees or partners, you can do it within the same account. Just create a new school and you are good to go. The platform is very user-friendly, so you are not relying on devs for changes that you might need to make, which gives you so much autonomy and flexibility. So if you're ready to upgrade your academy experience or rethink how you deliver product education, check out learnworlds.com today. And enter the code CELAB15 for 15% off the first 6 months of your subscription.
To CLAB, the Customer Education Lab. That's right. CLAB stands both for customer education and certainly excellent, where we explore how to build customer education programs, experiment with new approaches, and exterminate the myths and bad advice, and in my case, bad acronyms and initialisms that stop growth dead in its tracks. I am Adam Evermescu, and I am honored to be here today with Kelly Mullaney, head of AI Guild at Juniper Square. Hello, Kelly.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining. I want to jump right into it, but also just, you know, by way of starting with those pleasantries, it's not just pleasantries. Actually, like, you and I have been in the same communities for a really long time. Like, at this point, I would say, like, back to the late Paleolithic era or something like that. Like, I remember very distinctly some of those early days in the Slack channels. And so, like, actually, yeah. It's strange. It's strange that we haven't done this yet.
It is really odd. I've been admiring your work forever. You're one of the first people that I heard, like, advertising for customer education and speaking about what it can do, and obviously wrote a book on it. And it is interesting that we haven't aligned yet and found time to talk.
Well, thank you for saying that. And equally, I mean, like, I think in the community, like, you have always been one of the people who, when you speak up, it's credible. Like, I think you're very active and generous in sharing your point of view and really helping people. But, like, similarly, I mean, I keep developing, like, an increasingly strong conviction about this, that, like, especially with now, like, a lot of people just popping prompts sloppily into ChatGPT or what have you, like, it's easier than ever for people to just, like, share on LinkedIn and places like that just because they can, but there's not a whole lot of substance behind it. And like, what I think that you did before our, like, AI-enabled future, but what I see you even doing, like, more of, I would say now, is, like, when you're popping up, you're sharing things that are, like, super practical and tangible and helpful, and I think actually helping, like, show people in our field where the future is and what types of things can be built and how they how we can deliver value with them. And that's really why I wanted to talk to you today.
I love it. Yeah, my idea when I share is to basically show what's been built and not talk theoretically. I think that for a lot of customer education people, maybe it's cool to look at AI through the lens of, like, electricity. Like, when electricity kind of came out, like, people didn't get the value out of it for about 30 years later, because they basically just took an existing process. They're like, okay, we're just going to build electricity on it. And they didn't get that value for, like, 30 years. And what they kind of found out is, let's rewire the factory. Let's completely redefine how it's being done. And I think AI is the same thing. It's like not going in and just inserting it into an existing process. It's reimagining it. And so when I show my builds, I'm really just trying to show how you can reimagine your organization around AI.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I think that's great because like for a lot of people in our field, like either like people haven't been able to come as far yet with the technology that exists, or like the technology moves so quickly that there's always something new to discover. And I think, frankly, like there are a lot of folks out there who are AI curious, but maybe haven't had like the opportunities or the at-bats to like really build things in the context of their organization that like really deliver that level of value. So really eager to jump in with you to that. But first, like maybe it would be helpful to set a little bit of context, right, for kind of how you got to where you are today. Because, I mean, first of all, AI Guild, that's a super interesting and intriguing concept. But also, like, even going back to, like, when I met you in the community, you were at that time, I remember your handle was Kelly InvestNet. And now you're Kelly Juniper Square, as if we should be defined by our companies. But, like, can you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of like how you got into this and the whole place and how that brought you to where you are today?
Yeah. So my first job was like the most boring job in the world. So I started out as a tech writer, and I started back in the day, Microsoft made a tax product. So it competed with like TurboTax to help you prepare taxes. And I started there, and my job was to go down as a tech writer every line on a tax return and define what you'd enter. So like on line 7, entering wages. And I used to joke to my friends that like if they couldn't sleep, just call me up and ask me about my day, because taxes isn't the most glorious thing. But that kind of took me off into the world of fintech. And so after that, I joined InvestNet and ran the customer education department there, and then ultimately ran it for all business units. So for people that don't know, InvestNet, about, I think it was a $5 billion company at the time, maybe 5,000 people. And I ran the education function for that. So tech writing, internal enablement, e-learning, onboarding, all of that stuff. And eventually I joined Juniper Square to run the customer education department. And due to my aptitude for AI, I'm now running AI Guild, which is helping people get the most out of AI, either by building it for them or empowering them to build themselves.
And is that on top of your existing customer education scope, or is this actually?
No, it's a. I actually moved a few months ago, moved over to helping people build. You know, I figure I can probably provide the most value in the organization by helping people, you know, 10x their productivity. And so I think it's like the next phase of enablement in my view.
What a cool move. Because also, I mean, first of all, I don't see a lot of people making the move from like external facing customer education into like internal enablement, but like especially doing it through the lens of moving into AI enablement. Like, I think that's such a cool opportunity to take the skills that you've honed in the customer education world, but also then, apply it to actually helping people, you know, kind of like move into the AI future in a way that's like exciting yet comfortable, let's say.
It is. And some of it's just dumb luck that I got in there. It's like when ChatGPT launched and kind of kicked this off, and what was that, November of 2022, mm-hmm. What did it do well? It wrote, right? And so everybody's sitting there, hey, it's going to take tech writing's jobs and all that. And so I made the choice then to just kind of face the person that was going to take me out, so to speak. And through that, I was kind of first. I've just been using it longer. As you said, people haven't had the at-bats. Well, I got them really, really early. And I think it kind of just worked out for me that I've just had years and years of using it, but because it was going to impact my job so clearly.
Yeah, that makes sense. And maybe this would be a good time to talk about this too, because, you know, in the pre-show, you and I were talking a little bit about this. Like, I think neither of us are really like doomers about like customer education jobs when it comes to AI, but like, I'm curious more about your point of view on that.
Yeah. You know, do you remember like the crap test in college when you were writing like papers and what you could cite? It ran through the crap test. I'm not sure if you remember that.
Crap test.
One of the the crap, and it's like C-R-A-A-P, crap test. And one of the things that it did to kick out a source is to basically go, okay, does it have clear bias? So you couldn't cite that in your paper. And I think the same kind of thing's going on with AI. It's like, do we need to be listening to Dario and Sam Altman on the impacts of technology on the economy? Probably not, because they have a clear bias to say that. And I lean more optimistic. I look at, like, all right, who are all the top economists out there and what are they saying about the impacts of AI and technology on the job market? And it's really, really clear to me that it's, sure, there might be some short-term pains, but long-term, we're going to get job categories we've never seen before and a ton of new opportunity to open up. How do you see it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I see it similarly in the sense that, I mean, even if you look within companies like OpenAI and Anthropic, like they have customer education teams, they have digital CS teams, they have scaled teams, right? Like they're doing this work. And I know, well, I don't know, like I believe that like maybe if you ask them, they might have a more nuanced point of view on like why they've built up some of these functions in the sense that, hey, you know, when AGI, you know, really hits and manifests, like maybe we don't need any of these roles anymore. But If they have them now, first of all, like I think that speaks to even the companies who are on the frontier are still doing this work, and there's still a need both for this function and for humans who have expertise in this function to do it. But also, I mean, what I'm seeing is in a lot of cases, you have now these small customer education teams who are AI enabled, right? Like we actually had an episode that just aired recently, which was about running a customer education team of one with like an agentic education approach, which was super cool. It was with Jess Katz and listeners, like check that one out as well. But like those teams have always existed, right? It's actually like in some ways the anomaly in recent histories for customer education teams to turn into these gigantic Mondo teams with like such huge headcount. And that might be in some ways related to the scope of the team or the level of delivery that is needed or covering across multiple markets or doing, you know, live paid training and things like that, like actually needing to fly people out places. Well, that still exists, right? It's not like the humans have gone away. And as long as humans exist in businesses, like those things are still going to be needed. But for the scalable stuff, I mean, at least the way that I'm seeing it, small, lean customer education teams have always existed. They will continue to exist. And the technology that we have now is just going to make those same teams more powerful. And in a way, what that's hedging against, I think, is more like those teams overinflating over time.
I see it the same way. I could have probably said the same exact thing. I've said it before, so I love that we're aligned there. Yeah. I think, yeah, people are going to be managing agents, and how content gets generated will probably shift over time. Meaning, like, okay, take like a release note. Like, a good basis of that is going to be the why, and then you're going to have, and customer education, when you insert yourself into the SDLC, you know, you're asking all those questions along the way to fuel what you're going to do, and then you build your outputs. And it's not like 100% of the time that we're like the first person asking that question. It's probably happening early in the SDLC. The product manager probably is in grooming, telling people why we're building this. And so if you can build the systems to capture that knowledge, you can generate things like that automatically. But what you do after that is going to be a human running an agent, I believe.
Yeah, I agree. And like to that end, again, one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk to you is because you have been building and sharing a lot of these, agentic or vibe coded products and experiments that you've been working on. And so I would love for you to walk me through, we can take a few of them as examples. And first of all, think about, you know, how you got the idea to do some of these. Would love to hear more about, you know, some of the different tools that you've used, because, you know, I was, you know, kind of scrolling through the timeline and looked overall, your AI tech stack seems to have changed a little bit over time too. And also then thinking about like, what do we do after, these products are released and now we're responsible for maintaining them over time? Because I think we should probably talk a little bit about like the total cost of ownership of of you know, vibe coded products that we build and maintain versus, you know, paying for SaaS subscriptions. And you know, there's a push and pull there.
Yeah. Yeah. The buy versus build math really, really changed with what Claude Desktop and Opus 4.5. So the first thing I do when I approach a build is I'm really mindful of the fact that like 95% of AI initiatives fail. I think that was like Harvard or something came out with that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because people are building tools for specific use cases or they don't enable on it appropriately. And I really spend time thinking about what's a tool that is applicable to everyone that everybody can use. An example of that might have been, I built like a help center. I was basically like, okay, do I need to keep using Zendesk Guide or do I need to go and buy like Mintlify? Yeah. And my idea from that was, what if I could automate writing the how? Like maybe I don't get the positioning stuff when writing, but what if I can write the how? And my thought process behind that was, well, what knows how something works? Well, the code does. And the idea that I wanted to solve for is if somebody could check in code and I monitor the Git repo, can I pull the code, bring it into my context window, and generate an output? And that's what I did in one of the things that I showed is just check in code. It goes through, it writes a release note, and it writes everything. And building on that, like what if I went and built a connector over to Jira and I grabbed the ticket in the Epic or the initiative and pulled in some of the why, like, could I get myself 80% there? And that's really what I want.
Yeah. And this was one that I was super interested in as well, because it looks like, I mean, first of all, well, I think you even mentioned you were thinking of releasing the source code at some point, but like, I'm interested in the tooling that you used for this and kind of how you went about building and iterating on.
Yeah. So I build generally in Claude Code Desktop. The database I often use is Supabase, but I'm flexible on that. And that's just backend as a service. And it's setting up the database in English in the same way that I'm generating the code. I'm just talking to it. The plugin that I prefer for my SDLC is called Superpowers. And what it does is it does a really good job of asking you questions about what you're building and understanding the problem so that when you get to the end, you don't have to iterate on top of it. And I like it because AI can take an input you give it, but that's really limited by the things you think to tell it or questions you think to ask it. And what Superpowers really does is it asks you a bunch of clarifying questions about what you can build. And oftentimes those are things you haven't even thought through when you're going to approach the problem. So Superpowers, Supabase, and then Claude Desktop. And then oftentimes I'll bounce my ideas off of other LLMs just to refine my thinking. Like I just will use another one and be like, okay, this is what Claude's telling me. What do you think, Gemini? And that really helps refine my thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. And so in this case, then you have it actually like scanning like GitHub as like different like as different commits are happening, right? To see like what's actually updating in the product and then use that. I'm assuming like with some like predetermined prompts as well to like then know like, okay, based on that, here are the things that I should look for. Here are the things that I should try to document on it. Or like if someone also uploads like a PRD or a changelog or something like that, then like it can do the same. Is that like generally how it's working?
Yeah, that's basically it. It looks at the commits and it determines if it's a material change. And for me, what that means is if there's a front end component or it changes some meaningful functionality. There are a lot of check-ins that are going to be bug fixes that some companies advertise, some don't, and don't matter. So it analyzes that and then it kind of runs it through essentially prompt engineering, as you said. It basically is like, okay, here is exactly what you're going to do and create the outputs. But it also goes out and fetches from some other sources. So it looks at like Jira, for example, and pulls in stuff there. And then I've built in all of the different style guides so you can define how you're going to write. So an example would be like, you know, pulling a Microsoft style guide for technical publications and pull in Chicago and then write it that way. So yeah, it just writes the whole thing. Is it 100% perfect? No. But is it 80% there? Yeah.
So that raises, I think, then a different interesting question. I want to come back to a different one that happened in my mind, but while we're on this, like, then, so what's happening afterwards? Like, how are you doing that, like, additional 20% refinement? Or is the 80% good enough to print? Are you doing manual review and editing? Are you running it through another agent that's double checking? Like, tell me about that.
Yeah, I believe strongly in human in the loop. And so it's just picking it up and then verifying its output is essentially it. I think one thing that occurs to me is I don't know if help centers as they're designed today are going to be needed in the future in the same way. And if tech writing isn't going to be the presentation layer any longer, it's going to be the training layer. And so it occurs to me that AI can do something that just fixed text cannot, and that is it can ask you a question. And as a tech writer, that has always been the bane of my existence, is that I can't speak to you. Like, I can't talk to my audience. And my belief is that AI can write the right question. So I picture a world in which the tech writing is not actually surfaced to the learner. And what happens is it writes customized articles and help content for you through its, you know, like through its interface, like normally Help Center. You know, how can I help you today? Similar exactly to how like Claude AI works. It's the same kind of thing, but if it can ask you questions and then build the knowledge base articles just for you, so much more powerful.
Yeah. And so like what I hear from what you're bringing up in this case as well is that increasingly, especially when we talk about documentation and documentation and help centers, I guess, is that just as much as we have been writing for human users of the product, we are now writing more for, I mean, what a lot of people are calling like AEO, or let's just say, you know, like searchability and discoverability for other LLMs and AI products to ingest, which means that, like, on one hand, the accuracy still needs to be high, right? Like, we can't not have a human in the loop process because AI is still prone to hallucination or might even just not get something entirely right because it doesn't have the context for it. But that the output, like what I'm hearing from what you're saying, is that, like, it's not as much optimizing for human readability anymore as like making sure that it can actually get ingested into other AI products that can contextualize and then support the user based on that.
That's exactly it. It's basically building the corpus that AI is going to feed from. And like picture, like, I don't know, you're an educator at like HP and you're handling printers. You know, if somebody can't print, you can write a knowledge base article or build a video on possible reasons for that, but are you going to get down to the edge case, like somebody's like on vacation and they're thinking that they can just print to their computer at home? Like, you're probably not going to have that in like number one on your troubleshooting article, but AI can get there, and it's going to make us so much more powerful. But we do need to write essentially the corpus where it's going to have enriched company information in there to answer it properly, so it's not guessing when it doesn't have context.
Yeah. And I think that's super cool. Like looking at some of the features that you incorporated into this, and maybe you can expand on some of these too. Like, it's not just about having that content generation workflow about monitoring all the commits and deciding what to document and producing the initial documentation and going through the editorial workflow. Like, that's table stakes. That's already awesome, but that's also table stakes. But that you've also incorporated into this, you know, like an AI chat assistant so the customers can ask those questions in plain language and get answers, and then, like, based on that, also look at like search gaps to figure out where there should be additional documentation or new questions to answer. And then of course, like an analytics layer on that too, to like be able to actually have some observability for what people are doing like in those docs. I think that's super cool.
Thank you. Yeah, my idea at first was basically going, you know, what if I could just make a help center AI? Like if fixed articles just went away and it was just going to generate them on the fly. And as I started using it as a user, I was kind of like, yeah, that's a heavy change for somebody to wrap their mind around. And what I built is let's do the AI layer on top of a fixed help center. So that way you could have your choice. And I felt like that made adoption a lot easier for people.
Yeah. Well, because I would imagine that, like, you know, if we think about the technology adoption curve, like even if it's possible today to generate a completely bespoke help experience, there's still going to be a lot of customers out there, right? When we think about like customer preferences from a behavioral standpoint, like they still want to know, here is a doc, I've gotten to it, this is the source of truth, someone has looked at it, I know that this is right.
That is right. And I think the other part that help centers do is like if you have a left nav or some kind of navigation structure, it shows you what's possible. It's like, oh, I see this section. I didn't know I could do that. So you kind of learn by browsing the page in and of itself. So there is value in that I don't know how to solve for. But I do like the AI component that in and of itself, it is self-enabling. You use Claude, for example, it's always saying, like, I don't know, you give it a spreadsheet. It's always like, hey, do you want me to build this into a PowerPoint deck or remove duplicates or something like that? It's always prompting you and showing you what you can do next. And I believe that if we can build that into our help centers, adoption can go up just because you're learning by using it.
Yeah. And I was thinking, even as you were saying, you know, kind of that last example, that increasingly that will probably start to also take the role of the left nav and understanding more of the art of the possible. But like the part to me that always feels a little bit tricky about saying, oh, well, this means that, fixed help centers will just go away eventually. Well, maybe eventually on some timeline, but, so much of the customer's experience with our products is contextual. And if you are in the help center because you're having a moment of crisis, that's very different from you being in the help center because you are trying to like discover a new use case, or maybe you're like more emotionally open to it at the moment. So I think like right now viewing it as an and, not an or, like not a replacement for the products that we've already built, is probably like also like even just a helpful way to look at it. Maybe not even like a stopgap.
Yeah. I agree. I think that, you know, Anthropic has a help center. I use it all the time. I can ask the questions through Claude if I want to, or I can go to their help center, and I do. It's hard to change those motions. And then, you know, help centers, they do have some of their value, but I think you do need to offer the choice. Like, let me give you a better mechanism for consulting, and then let me get you some, you know, pre-written release notes, for example, that are written with the positioning the company wants.
Yeah, well, and that brings up an interesting point too, because even like working with Anthropic, for instance, like you can ask Claude to answer a question for you. You can look at Anthropic's help documentation, and you can also work with their support team. But like even Anthropic, like, is not necessarily rebuilding something like Intercom Fin, right? Like for the AI based support, that product exists. It's well, now I think they actually have their own model powering it, but like, the reason I'm thinking about this is also because we talked about build versus buy. And I'm curious, like when you think about making these sorts of investments for your team, or like whether it makes sense to build and maintain a help center product, for instance, instead of working with, you named a few of the vendors earlier, like Zendesk, Mintlify, et cetera. Like, how do you think about that calculation? And how do you think about like the ongoing maintenance of products that you actually build yourself using AI?
Yeah. So I generally look at it through the lens that AI can get you 80% there for most things. It's not necessarily good at like the design side of things, but it can get you 80% there. Like I was able to replicate 80% of Zendesk Guide in a week And I keep that in mind. And the other thing that I look for potential disruption is if you're just a company that is just a layer on top of a frontier model, I think that those ones are easier to disrupt. And a good example for that is like competitive intelligence. It's like, yeah, ultimately, it's just
a clue competitor, right?
Yeah, it's like going out and just looking for market signals and then finding a way to get that to you. Sure, there's some special sauce in like probably having subscriptions to tools that I don't have, or like, you know, being able to scrape LinkedIn without getting kicked out. But at the same time, it's ultimately just doing agent searches and then pulling it in. And that was one that I actually just spent last weekend doing. I just basically made a Slack channel called Competitive Intelligence. I have 37 agents that manage agents, Claude manage agents, that go out and look, monitor all of our competitors and then give a daily intel brief into a Slack channel. And then I have a self-improving feedback loop for that, where basically people can forward over the message to a feedback channel, and then the bots just learn from all the feedback that they're giving. Anyway, I just look at it like ultimately, if we can get you 80% there and you're charging us $30,000, $60,000 a year, I like to revisit that math.
Yeah, and basically say, like, would I take 80% of this that I don't necessarily have to, like, put a ton of work into maintaining versus, like, having the 100 and pay this much for it? And, like, still in some cases, the vendors aren't going to, you know, deliver everything you might want out of that product anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's going, okay, is this one where I want to be able to control the roadmap? Like, when you buy SaaS, you're buying into a roadmap. And some companies haven't produce the roadmaps that I value. Like, speed is such a moat now.
Yeah.
And if they're not cooking along and stuff, well, maybe I can move faster. And that really weighs in. So, like, there are companies and tools that I've looked at that aren't moving. And then there are tools that are. Like, Part is a really good example of a company that moves quickly. I would be happy to buy into their roadmap versus like a storyline or something like that, which I see is moving along slower.
Yeah. And this actually like brings me to something I wanted to ask you about as well. So like, thank you for the free transition, which I'm now stepping on. Like you, a couple months ago, also built basically an e-learning course that you vibe coded, without using like Storyline or one of those products, and you built it in Claude Code. And so I'm curious, like, first of all, again, like maybe take us through a little bit of the process of what building that out was like. And I mean, it probably would even look a little bit different today with Claude Design, but how you might think about that versus like using a product like Parta, which you also just mentioned.
Yeah. What I would say is anything that is a critical business function, I'm not to the point where my confidence is that a vibe coded app is going to work perfectly all the time. I'm one person. I don't have all the testing resources and everything to really refine it. So would I trust my critical infrastructure to it? Not yet. You know, who knows what it's going to do in the future, but not yet. And I consider like e-learning courses to be critical infrastructure to my team. So in that case, yeah, I would choose an enterprise grade vendor for it. That being said, my mental model around doing that is ultimately that we don't need to be limited by what tools say that we can do. Like, you know, if you see a Rise course, every Rise course looks kind of similar.
Do you ever feel like your product team ships faster than you can build training?
Like.
Yeah, me too.
Oftentimes,
and that's why I've been checking out what the folks at Learn Experts are doing.
Than what the
their AI platform
provides.
Called Leah takes your existing
really
content,
going,
docs,
okay,
slides, wikis, recordings,
source.
And turns it into full training programs, publishing in multiple modalities to nail blended learning for your customers 85% faster than traditional methods.
Hey,
and get
go
this,
read that,
when your product updates, Leah can update the content
together.
Faster
so I just gave
by
it the
automatically
transcript,
incorporating
built it
into your existing outline
ran some basic
content,
reporting out of it,
even your end
up.
Of course test or exams.
Yeah.
LearnExpert shares that their
also
customers
then, I guess what I'm hearing you say is there's also a distinction between...
Now that's time back to actually focus on
well, okay.
strategy.
So like on one hand...
Well, let's be honest, to finally take a lunch break.
the legacy
Plus,
products that have existed in this
like
space,
like Skillshare and others, so that
like,
you can
let's say
our
Articulate Rise and things like that. Like,
check it out.
We very clearly see the limitations of those things.
And see
a lot
how
of native LMS
learning and testing
authoring
release mode.
Very clearly see the limitations in what can be done there. And I think you also even called that out in your post, right? Like, why are we limiting ourselves, and why are we also continuing to pay for those tools if they are actually like meaningfully impeding the experience for our learners and what we can create, and like creating additional work for us to maintain them over time? But then we can kind of go like one step forward to say, okay, well, if we're that limited by some of these legacy tools that are still critical infrastructure, can we work around them by using either, like in your case, Claude Code, or like now I think Claude Design would also be able to help a lot with these types of use cases, and do that. But like, there's kind of a third step, if I'm hearing you right, to say, well, but let's remember there's still critical infrastructure, and we still need to be able to produce these reliably. We still need to make sure that they're replicable on brand, that like if we have multiple people in the company working with them, that they can be updated and maintained in time. And that's when, again, like the script would flip to say, if there are vendors out there that can move fast enough to not give us those limitations, then it's worthwhile again to actually go with a vendor instead of trying to like build and maintain all of these as one-offs. Is that the equation? That is exactly
how I'm seeing it. I think a lot of these legacy tools have gotten comfortable in the fact that they felt that they had a moat. And what that stopped is from them moving quickly. So you have a choice with it now. You can partner with somebody who is moving fast and is, you know, using AI to generate a lot of their code and testing it and treating it as real enterprise grade, or you can bolt on top of those legacy tools. But I think, you know, the moat is moving fast. It's also having great service and great infrastructure. And so for tools that maybe you don't need that, sure, vibe coding 80% of the way there might work. But am I going to trust building my full e-learning course in Claude Code and having that work flawlessly 100% of the time? No, I would probably choose an enterprise grade vendor.
So like, for instance, when you built that, like you built it as an experiment, but not necessarily intending to like fully productionize that, more to challenge like the legacy LMS and authoring vendors.
That's exactly it. It's basically to go, you know, Claude could be coming for your lunch, so speed up. That was really the warning shot I had. And then it's also, you know, there are companies that can't go out and afford these tools. You know, they don't have the funding for it. And so would I rather have something that got me 80% of the way there or nothing? Of course, everybody's going to choose the 80%. And so it was to inspire those teams just getting bootstrapped to go, hey, you know, you don't have to do nothing. You can do something. Let me show you how.
Yeah, which goes back to something we were talking about at the top of this call, which is so many customer education teams, especially who are still in an early state, are still customer education teams of one. They're still working really lean. They still might not have the tools. And I'm even thinking, for example, of when I've told the story on the podcast before, so I'll keep this short. Like when I was at Optimizely and we didn't have an LMS yet, I came in, we were a customer education team of two, and we were basically just scrambling to make, you know, the help center and video. We didn't have the AI tools at that point, or well, nothing that would be recognized as AI today. And, we built the first version of our academy basically as a prototype on an instance of Zendesk Help Center. And so if we were in the same position today, we could make a much higher fidelity version of that, either Claude Code or let's say a similar tool. Like, we don't need to make this just about Claude, but like, you're right. It is possible. And the other point that you make in your post that I really like is that, like, even if you look at a lot of the traditional LMSs that are out there that are reliant on SCORM, they're only giving you like course enrolled, course completed, maybe like the score of a quiz or something like that. And the fact is, like, now we have the ability to measure so much more. And I think the vendors who win in this space are the ones who are going to like outpace what we can now collect ourselves and not just like stick to that kind of, you know, to your point, like very limited imagination of like what we could track in the past.
Yeah, I think, you know, the power of an LMS, right, is the reporting. I mean, like at its end, it's got a presentation layer and then a reporting layer. And if you're just like, you can't even track like session time in a lot of these. It's hard to track like, oh, how long were they actually in the course? Like, you're like, how did they pass in 2 seconds? And you realize, oh, if they were on a different tab or something like that, it messes up your metrics. And with AI, we can do different types of reporting. You know, I think a lot of people probably in the space have had the idea of going, well, I can just write it all with API calls in the future. And then you actually, you know, 5 years ago, you tried that and you realize that is really, really, really hard. And hiring the staff in order to fuel that vision is really, really hard as well. Well, now it's not.
Yeah.
You can hire Claude or you can hire, you know, OpenAI or whatever you use. Yeah.
Totally. And so like to that point, like maybe we can think about, well, you've actually described several different technologies, even like within the Claude stack, but we can genericize them if we want, right? We talked about Claude Code, we talked about Claude Design, we talked about managed agents, we talked about Claude Desktop. I think a lot of people know Claude, you know, the kind of the consumer chatbot product. If you're talking to someone who's like a team of one and maybe getting started and wants to explore these tools more, like, could you give a quick rundown of maybe like how some of these tools are similar or different from each other, or like how you might decide which of those tools to use to accomplish your goal?
Yeah. And that is a real challenge for a lot of people that I see is basically, okay, what do I use to solve what? And I'll just quickly walk through the Anthropic stack, because I think that is probably the one that gets a little bit confusing. You know, you have Claude AI, you've got Claude Cowork, you've got Claude Code, you've got Claude Design, you've got Managed Agent. So what are they? I'll walk you through each of them. Claude Chat is just Claude Chat. That's where you ask it a question and you get a reply. Claude Code, and especially the desktop, there's kind of two flavors of that. There's a desktop app that you install and use, and then there's just a terminal based. The one I'm talking about here is the desktop app part of Code. And that is where you generate code in plain English. You just basically go, hey, I'm thinking about building an e-learning course from this script that I want to be reportable. Can you help me build that? You just talk to it just like that. In fact, I would say that I use speech to text almost exclusively when vibe coding, just because I want it to almost have access to my id or my verbal thoughts or like my thoughts. And so anyway, that's the one that you're generating code. Cowork is kind of a bridge between those two. It is basically the idea, it's built on top of Claude Code, and it's the idea that it can help you automate workflows when maybe you don't need a front end to the software you're building. So an idea of that, if we want to go, is like, hey, run this skill, which is kind of like a pre-written prompt, and go out and do a competitive intelligence. And it will do that for you. And you just call it by typing slash and going. You can also make your own skills. Then on top of that, what they have are called plugins. And plugins are combine skills and then what are called MCP or connectors. And those are the systems at which it can connect to. So an example of that might be like Slack or Jira. So the skill works.
Like when you were talking earlier about having your help center product scan the code base for commits, like that would be through an MCP.
That's exactly it. And so an example for that one might be like, hey, go out and use the Atlassian Rovo MCP. Go grab the requirements for this epic and bring them in and then execute a skill to write my release note. That's just something really, really simple. And then the idea of these plugins is you're sharing them out to your groups. Then we have Claude Design. And Claude Design is really, at its core, kind of like a Gamma competitor. But the idea is that AI is really, really good at writing code, but for some reason, it's decided that design is not what I'm excellent at. And an example of that might be, like, I can write that entire help center product in a weekend, But then if I wanted to format a pixel perfect PowerPoint deck or slide deck, it's just like, no, that was their answer to it. And it also does that in software engineering. And what I mean by that is that you can tell what a vibe coded app looks like. Like they have their tells. And the idea of that is, well, can I load it up with my design system and how we've made enterprise grade design and then just sync that down into our products to give it our unique flavor and polish on it. And yeah. Then finally, managed agents are basically just, it's code that you can deploy to their servers, which saves you a lot of time for the infrastructure. I think probably long-term, it's going to be like an open cloud answer, but right now it's just shared memory and basically agents on it.
Yeah. And being able to like run some of these automations, for instance, without having your laptop open and running all the time or like waiting for it to catch up when you open the laptop again is.
That's exactly it. So in my competitive intelligence, right? Like I don't want to keep my laptop going for like, if I had it on like a co-work skill or something like that, I want to be able to just, you know, go to sleep and then wake up with my digest and my Slack channel. So it was a perfect answer for that.
And like, I think, again, it's probably also worth calling out. We just walked through the entire Anthropic stack, which like, again, I also agree is like a super useful one. And also for a lot of the work that we do, like in many cases, like super appropriate, super sufficient, but you know, for our audience as well. Like I know we have a lot of Gemini users out there who are also then like throwing things in, you know, Notebook LM, generating like images, Nano Banana, et cetera, et cetera. Like I know a lot of people kind of like shop around a little bit between the different providers. And I even saw that you in the past, like you had an example and probably would take me a moment to find which one where like you were using a different stack as well. Like I think you still had Supabase and a couple of the
others.
And Lovable. Yeah. So like, I'm kind of curious, like how you look at some of the different like alternatives out there and like how often you're maybe like switching between the alternatives versus going with like, I guess the consistency of sticking within a specific stack.
Yeah. It's something I struggle with. You know, the arms race of AI is real. Gosh, maybe 8 months ago or something like that, you know, ChatGPT was the front runner and everybody was all pro open AI. And then what was it? Gemini came along with their newest version like a month later and dunked on open AI. And then after time, Anthropic came out with Opus and it was better. And so there's always going to be an arms race. And the way that I see it is you have to be open to tool choice. Because if not, you're always going to be behind if somebody pulls ahead. But if that's not possible, I'd say where the models are today, I think they're all really, really good. Yes, Claude probably is going to excel at coding, and a lot of the other tools don't have a perfect answer for that, but they will over time. And for a lot of what most people are doing, I think just find what your company issues you and work for it. But if I were starting today, and I had choice and it was in my personal life, I would probably look at Claude right now just because its tool set is pretty robust.
Yeah. And you also bring up a good point in terms of looking at what your company actually has approved, right? Because you don't want to be like putting a bunch of company data into like a third party AI.
That is real. I think that's the complaint I hear often from talking to people at other companies. It's like, well, we can only use, you know, Copilot or whatever. And so there is frustration, I think, with people about what tools they're being given. I'm lucky at Juniper Square that I get all of Claude and every employee gets all of Claude. But at the same time, there is a time when Claude Desktop didn't exist and Claude wasn't the best. And we were, you know, doing great things just using OpenAI and using Gemini. So you can get value from any tool. It's not the tool. It's probably the person using the software.
No, and I think like again, like that's you've shown that really in your approach about thinking like how far you can get towards a use case that you want to accomplish, right? And like throwing different combinations of tools at it to get the job done. Like it doesn't like that shouldn't be the limitation. And at the same time, like for anyone who might be like a little bit nervous about AI or feeling like, oh, I have to keep up with like all of these tools and I have to know all of these things. No, like these are all options that are out there, but if there's something that you've started with that you're more comfortable with than like, and that's your way in, like, that's fine. Or if your company uses one thing and that's what you have to use to solve the problem, that's fine. And I think like one of the great things that you've shown throughout this conversation is that like, it really is more about your thinking about the problem statement and then figuring out like, how do we iterate towards solving that? How do we get towards that 80% than like knowing the exact capabilities of like every single tool?
Yeah, I think that in customer education in particular, we're, I think, the most well-aligned to take full advantage of AI. I would say that most of us aren't coders, and so we see opportunities and not the potential problems that you have, and that optimistic mindset is really, really helpful. And the second part of it is that customer education has leaders that are intellectually curious. I don't think that a lot of people got into customer education going, I want, you know, the top paying job in the world. If not, they would have went into sales or something like that. And so they have that intellectual curiosity. And what makes good AI users and bad AI users is the questions that you ask. And customer education leaders are going to be so excellent at asking the right question. And I think that's really the core of it. And then the other part of it is the only way to get into Carnegie Hall is practice. And we've talked about how AI is self-enabling, and just use it. And it's okay if you fail and your first coded app is a throwaway app, but just get your at-bats and use it.
Yeah. And again, love that you jumped into it early, and like we can see what you're doing now as a proof of that. And I think still as a proof of, for customer education in the future, what that human in the loop is still going to look like. Because yeah, I mean, as much as we can say, like, there might be a day where all of this is fully automated, I just hard for me to see that coming like so soon that any of us needs to be so worried about that. Probably better for us to figure out like how to be creative with the tools that are available to solve some of those parts of the job that have been traditionally difficult or limiting for us, either because of our access to information or because of the tools available or because of where the knowledge sits, like whatever it is, right? Like, I think like proper use of these tools and creative use of these tools is going to make things easier for us, even though like, yes, in customer education, like we're still always going to have to be scrappy. But that's been the case, you know?
That's always been the case. It's just going to amplify your impact and make that easier. As you said, look at what, you know, Anthropic has customer education. OpenAI has customer education, and they're using models that we don't even have access to. They're way ahead of us, and they still run the function for a reason.
I know the people on those teams, like they have incredibly talented people doing that work. So it's not, you know, it's not like they've like devalued that function either. Like, clearly they see the value in doing this.
Well, exactly. And for those doing the video-based learning too, I think a good signal is, what did OpenAI do recently? They probably had $10 billion in their video side of their business, and they just discontinued it. Because they were basically like, okay, the compute costs in order to do this are just too expensive. And that makes sense to me. It's like, how many images would you have to create like 1 second of video? What is that, like 60 frames or something like that? The compute costs are going to outweigh everything else. And that's why they just threw, you know, $10 billion or something away. And so it's not even coming for video yet. It's too expensive.
No, and at the same time, like for those of us who are producing video-based education, for instance, the tools that are available to us now, like Kluso, HeyGen, not even getting into like some of the voice, like 11 Labs, all of that, right? Like there's so many great tools now available to us, even though you're right, like OpenAI deprecated, what was it called, Sora?
Yeah.
Like maybe in the consumer world, like that cost-benefit analysis doesn't work out, but we do have, at this point, pretty fantastic point tools available to us to make that side of our jobs easier. So like, if anything, like comes back to what you were saying about it more like unlocking possibilities and overcoming some of the limitations, especially for teams that aren't fully resourced with like huge production studios and, you know, full teams working on this, like as a.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And then I would say that it's also imagining a world in which, you know, engineers are 10 times more productive and code is coming out at 10 times the rate. And it's going does my workflow work in that area? Can it, like, does it scale? And is it going to lead to, like, cognitive overload? And so it's reimagining what customer education could look like in a, at a time where people are pumping out 10 times X as much code. And then, as you said, how do I do that with a scrappy team?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Well, Kelly, like, again, thank you for your time and sharing your expertise, and also being for so being so public, sharing on LinkedIn what you're building. Maybe just to close things out, do you have any other advice that you would offer to other customer education professionals or customer education leaders who are maybe getting into AI, maybe have some like early use cases, but like really feel like they want to go deeper and maybe just don't know exactly how to do it yet?
Yeah, I would say the first piece of advice that I would give is don't try to like insert AI into existing processes. Like you can go, okay, here's my SDLC and let me just try to
Which I think we should probably define at this point, right? We've said that term a few times, software development lifecycle.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Yep.
So how your software is being built, like don't just go, okay, I'm going to insert AI in there because it seems like a good opportunity. It's to imagine what the world for education and your company could look like with AI infused in it. And the second part that I would say to people who that want to get started is don't be afraid. Just jump in and use it and know that your education mindset is going to make you so powerful with this stuff because you're going to ask the right questions and you're going to understand how users think extremely well. Sure, your early stuff might be throwaway, and that's okay. There's learnings in the failures. I've done so much throwaway work and burned so many tokens, but I learned every single time and it's helped me level up. So just use it.
Amazing. Well, Kelly, again, thank you so much. I agree, by the way, like it's all scary until it's not.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, cool. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing. And I mean, again, like you inspired me in terms of thinking about what can be done with AI in our field. And I hope for our listeners that this was also as inspiring, if not more. And if you listeners want to learn more, we have a podcast website at customer.education. You can find all the stuff there that you would find on a podcast website. And you can also find us on LinkedIn. Kelly, where would you like to be found?
LinkedIn is great.
Okay, we love LinkedIn. And we also love Alan Coda, who does our theme music. You can see him play in like 6 different bands if you are in the Austin, Texas area. So definitely check him out. And if this helps you out, please subscribe to our show wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and especially on Apple Podcasts. We would love a 5-star review. And if you are listening right now and you're like, I haven't done that yet, maybe you can take this moment to open the app and just leave a cheeky little 5-star review. There's no time like the present, because that really helps us keep this thing going after so many years. And of course, to our audience, thanks for joining us. Go out and educate, experiment, and find your people or your managed agents. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. It's an honor.